And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
Welcome to the Full 60 featuring Craig Custance and presented by The Athletic. Each week, we'll dive into the biggest stories in hockey while bringing in unique voices to entertain and explain all aspects of the game.
Hey, this is Craig, and welcome to this week's episode of the Full 60, where I am thrilled to be joined by the person who, in my opinion, may have the best title in all of hockey, Sonny Mehta, who is the Vice President of Hockey Strategy and Intelligence for the Florida Panthers, a relatively new, not brand new, position for him. Sonny, how are you? Thanks for doing this.
Thanks, Craig. Good to be here. Thanks.
So I just like that, you know, Vice President of Hockey Strategy is fine. I like that somebody tacked on in intelligence. Was that a part of the negotiation?
I'm trying to think of how, like, because people have asked me this before, and yeah. I think it was, I'm trying to remember back, it kind of just happened. It was like, you know, Bill and I kind of both agreed that we kind of just didn't really like analytics, the word. And then I think, I want to say it was actually Doug Fearing, who I worked with at Zealous. He was the former head of analytics for the Dodgers, and now he started Zealous. I think he was the one who kind of suggested, we were talking about something, and he suggested how kind of like the hip new title in a lot of AI fields and stuff is to be like, whatever, VP of intelligence or something like that. And I think, as I remember correctly, I think Bill really liked that, and then also said, I think strategy should be in there too. And I was like, okay. Sounds good. That works. And it kind of, it was pretty much just completely made up. Hodgepodge together.
Well, that's how all titles are. I've changed my title 10 times to try to find the perfect one here at The Athletic. Now I found it. I can't wait to switch again.
What is it now?
Thanks for asking. We've done a bit of a reorg, and I'm now senior managing editor of the NHL group. I had previously been editor-in-chief of the NHL US, which maybe sounds better because there's a chief in there. But we've now, we're already in the weeds, but Myrtle and I, he was in Canada and I was in the US. And so we tore down the walls that were dividing our country and our coverage. We merged it into one big happy family and we're working together and it's great. And so we had to redo those. So that's our title. Yeah, but now I'm going to go back to management and say I would like to be senior managing editor of hockey strategy and intelligence. I think you won that battle. How did you end up in Florida? Like, did you know Bill Zito and like, did you guys have a relationship prior?
We did, yeah. So I actually met him at a Sloan Sports Analytics conference panel. I guess it was about 2-3 years ago at this point. We just both happened to be on the hockey panel 2 or 3 Sloans ago. And so, yeah, we just met.
Who was moderating that one? Do you remember?
Dello. Yeah, one. Dello. Yeah, it was Dello. I can't remember everybody else who was on the panel that year. I've done a few of them. I know, you know, obviously for sure that one was, Bill was on that one. And yeah, we met there and just, you know, I guess had a connection and so kept in touch and yeah, kept in touch pretty closely over the last 3 years or 2 years, whatever it was, you know, became pretty good friends and talked a lot, you know, every so often about stuff. And so, yeah, he hired me actually pretty soon after he started, like maybe about a week or 10 days after he started. So it was great.
Was there much of a pitch, or what was the pitch to get you back in from Bill?
Well, you know, I guess just from knowing him over the last few years, I knew how interested he was in this. You know, I think a lot of situations otherwise across the NHL are often not driven from the general manager. They're driven elsewhere, whether that's from ownership or maybe someone else in hockey ops that says, this is something we should do. And then they hire an analytics person. This was very, very different. This was like, you know, all along Bill sort of having in his mind that, you know, I would be, you know, this right, one of his right hand people, and that this, you know, that's almost why it's not about quote unquote analytics. It's just,
right.
This is just information. I mean, this is something that is not just a gravy on top. This is something that's an essential part of the fabric of what we do at Hockey Ops. And so that,
right.
You know, was obviously exciting to me. I mean, there was, you know, I had a great thing going prior to this, working with Doug at Zealous and also, you know, consulting with the Caps.
Yeah.
But this was just, you know, it was so exciting. It was just too good an opportunity to turn down. It was just great, and it's been awesome. So
it's interesting because you have the perspective of being at the outset of the analytics movement in hockey with your time with New Jersey, and now you're returning. Not that you left. I mean, you were still consulting, like you said, with the Caps, but now you're back into it. When I think it has changed. What do you see as the biggest change now versus maybe a few years ago in New Jersey?
I guess, you know, there's more data available. The data's better and there's more available. I think people are a bit more well-versed in it, or at least familiar with its value and what it is. Whereas I think, you know, when I first started the Devils, gosh, what was that, 2014, there was just so much that was new to everybody. Whereas I don't think that's so much the case now.
Right.
Having said that, there are a lot of things that I don't think are that different in terms of, I think if you went back and asked me in 2014, well, what will things be like 7 years later? I might have had a different answer than I might have thought certain things would be further along. And in a lot of ways, they aren't. But as, you know, coincidentally, that's actually somewhat helpful for me because, you know, even though I started 4 months ago, I don't in any way, shape, or form think that we're playing catch up as much as I probably should have. So, you know, there's that.
Right. Like, I'm kind of reading between the lines. How much of that is just the lack of the kind of progress in the player tracking and where that was supposed to be by now?
I don't know if that's a huge part of it. I think that might be somewhat part of it. But more than anything, like, that coming into play is probably motivating people to push further into it. But I don't, you know, had a lot of people had that desire prior to this, I don't know if the tracking data itself would have made as much of a difference towards what I'm talking about. I think it's more just, you know, there have only been a select few number of organizations that have really taken the ball and run with it, taken the puck and skated with it, whatever the analogy is here.
Right. In terms of an overall kind of buy-in, you mean?
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. I found it interesting that it seems like when a team that isn't, let me rephrase that, when a team that is kind of very public with their analytics use fails, there's still this celebration from the old school, like, look at this team isn't doing well. I know Tampa Bay is pretty involved, and I didn't hear a lot of people celebrating that as this analytics breakthrough, which was odd to me, like, or even acknowledging it. I don't know why I just thought that, but like it seemed like I think the analytics space has been waiting for that, you know, that moment when one of theirs or whoever wins, and like maybe that's already been happening and people aren't even realizing it.
Yeah, honestly, you would probably know more about that than me. I try to, you know, I think what you're talking about might be 100% true, sort of from the public facing view or what was presented in the media. Whereas, I don't know, my impressions are kind of based on more of what I know. And I know that,
right.
You know, I mean, for example, like the Capitals won the Cup, 2018? And I mean,
that's right.
They're one of the best smart. They're one of the smartest organizations in the league, and they probably don't get talked about nearly as much as other teams in terms of being a quote unquote analytics organization. But so I just think that that sort of thing happens all throughout. Like, it, you know, what people might see from reading articles might not actually be what's happening. So
that's a great point.
It's just not.
Yeah, I mean, I know you're not losing sleep over it. Right. Yeah. But you're right. Like, the Capitals winning the Stanley Cup, you're right. Like, that's an organization that is, you know, is into it. And it's influential. And, you know, you look at that front office and the people that make up that front office and have influence, it's, you know, they're in. And it's like, you know, Tim Barnes is one of the best at what he does. And yeah, you weren't hearing that a lot. You're right. And I don't know why that is. There's just some teams it seems connected to and some teams it doesn't.
Yeah. I mean, that's like that with everything, right? You know, I mean, sometimes things and players and in all industries, certain things get popular for whatever reason. There's not like a direct correlation between popularity and strength or success or skill.
Right.
So this is probably no different.
So what have you guys you guys are kind of like, I look at the team that Bill has built in the front office there. You know, you have a veteran coach in Joel Quenneville who, even when I talked kind of casually to Bill about it, seems like he's receptive to your ideas. What in this kind of early going of forming a front office, what does that look like to try to make sure everybody's voice is heard and you guys are able to kind of communicate the way you need to communicate? What are the strategies you guys use there?
You know, I don't know if it was an overt strategy. I mean, I'm sure it all was, like, from Bill's point of view, but from my point of view, you know, it was a funny situation because Bill, as I said earlier, Bill got hired and hired me as well as, you know, a few of his other sort of inner cabinet people, like, very soon after that. And it was kind of like, well, he hired me and he was like, dude, you know, get your ass to Florida because we have 2 weeks before the draft, you know, and
yeah,
the agency.
Yeah.
So it was, you know, it was a unique situation that he was in terms of taking over a team and then having so little time between that point and two major, major events in terms of both the entry draft as well as free agency. So, you know, on the one hand, that's a difficult situation. And I thought, you know, he did a phenomenal job. But on top of that, there's a benefit, I think, in that, in just everybody kind of getting thrown into the fire. And I mean, it was just so, that's what I meant earlier is, like, it almost wasn't a strategy. It was almost just like, we're all going to get thrown into this and collaborate because there's really no other choice here. You know, like, right, we have to get this done. We have 2 weeks. So, and I think that situation is pretty much carried through since that. Like, I think in a lot of ways it was kind of a blessing in disguise because that's the sort of foot that Hockey Ops got started off on. And it was great.
I don't know how big the analytics department is or what your plans are for it, but where has your focus been? Because as you said, you had to jump right in and you have a draft a minute later. Has it been roster construction? Has it been working with a coaching staff? Like, where would you say you're spending most of your time?
It's a bit of everything. I kind of think my job by nature is cyclical based on the part of the season that we're in. So yeah, those, you know, first weeks leading up to the draft and free agency, I mean, draft-wise, it was all focused on amateur stuff and player evaluation for amateur-related things and also, you know, strategic elements to help Bill in terms of just draft strategy and probabilities and things of that nature.
Yeah.
You know, free agency was focused a lot on, of course, player evaluation and our own pending free agents as well as free agents that were out there. And then, you know, I would say now at this point in the season, a lot of my focus is a lot of dialogue with the coaches and kind of self-evaluation, like evaluating our own team. It's early in the season still, so we're still trying to figure out, well, okay, you know, what are we doing well? What are we not doing well? How do we stack up? How are certain players fitting in that, you know, we would hope would fit in a certain way? So I'm sure it'll be, you know, a bit of that. And then, you know, with trade deadline not that far away. There'll be probably more focused stuff on that. And then, you know, the cycle kind of just starts again. So,
right.
Yeah.
When you say draft probabilities, what is, or probabilities around draft, what does that mean?
Maybe, probability was, I guess, a really general use of that word right there. But thinking more of just the strategic aspect of, does it make sense to draft certain players in certain spots? Does it make sense to make certain trades? From my perspective, it's such a crazy time. Like during the draft, everything's going on, everything's going nuts. Bill's getting calls left and right. And so, you know, my goal is always to have all that stuff already done and figured out so that when decisions need to be made, you know, I can chime right in and help him with that.
Right. I'm always curious where analytics come into play. I mean, when it comes to draft, and because it is probably, to me, for as an outsider, I look at where can teams improve the most as an organization and have an impact. And it's, I don't know if the needle has moved, right? It seems like if you get a player and a half out of each draft, you're probably doing okay. And that doesn't, in terms of probabilities or whatever, that doesn't seem like a great ratio. And I always wonder if analytics is going to move that needle. Or how, or what that looks like.
Yeah, I mean, on the one hand, the draft is no different than anything else in that it's, you know, it's, to me, from my perspective, it's all just risk decision making. And this is kind of risk decision making in its purest form, right? I mean, you have really, really set structured guidelines in terms of you pick in a certain order, you can only pick between these, you know, within this pool of players. So it's not different from that perspective. But on the other hand, I totally agree with you, like in terms of moving the needle. And I think it's just, I mean, it's really hard, you know? I mean, it's really hard to predict what 18-year-olds are going to do over the next 15, 20 years. That's just a hard task. It's a hard human task. I think data and information and, you know, I guess analytics it already has helped and it will help, but it doesn't make the task necessarily much easier.
Right, right. I said a player and a half. I'm now looking at Florida Panthers draft. I think, the front office wouldn't have changed if they would have gotten a player and a half out of each draft. I'm not, you know, that's certainly an area. And I know it's hard to talk about the now, right? When you're talking about what you're doing, because I know teams are protective or whatever. I would like to take a second here to talk about your experience in New Jersey, and especially because it was at such an interesting time. You said it was 2014. I'm not sure when you got hired in New Jersey, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, if there was another full-time analytics person in hockey. Was there? Were you the first?
I was the first, as far as I know. I had originally consulted for Phoenix back in 2011. Right. That was when Matt Holzhizer was slated to buy the team, but his deal fell through.
That's right.
I was in Chicago trading derivatives for him for his hedge fund. And then Josh Harris and David Blitzer bought the Devils. And, you know, they're also at the time, you know, young, very quantitatively inclined people. And so they wanted to start the first full-time department. And so they kind of had heard about me through the grapevine and hired me. And yeah, that kicked off a lot of things. Like Tim got hired in Washington not long after that. Kyle got hired in Toronto really soon after that. And there was another couple. Oh yeah, Dello in Edmonton. I think Tulski in Carolina. So
yeah,
it all, you know, yeah, it was, things were different then, 2014.
It seems like a lifetime ago. Oh my gosh. What did you find the biggest challenge? And like, what do you think your biggest lesson in that, during that stint was in the NHL side?
There were a lot of them. I mean, overall, it was just such an awesome experience. And it was so awesome. It was great. You know, I mean, I got to work for Lou Lamoriello, who was kind of my childhood hero. And Josh and David were awesome, and Ray was great too. It was also a difficult time. You know, it was a difficult time in the kind of lineage of the franchise too, between the team being so good for so long, and you know, as we see with a lot of organizations, it can kind of catch up to you. And we were kind of right in, I mean, we didn't know it at the time, but we were kind of right on that threshold of the sort of old era, I think, kind of coming, dwindling down, and the new era kind of beginning. And so there, you know, there were a lot of changes, both with Lou leaving and then Ray coming in. And so it was, yeah, there were challenges about it, but overall it was just a really, really awesome experience.
And you built a staff, right? Like that was the exciting thing. You weren't just kind of like a one-off.
Yeah. I think you even at some point talked to Cy, who worked for me.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, I love Cy.
Yeah. He was just fantastic. He was great. We did great, great things there. That was, you know, I mean, we had an early start. We built out a really nice infrastructure, and it was great. I think it was more than anything. The timing was a little tough just in terms of the timeline of the franchise. But I look back with nothing but just sort of, you know, proud of what we did from an analytics standpoint, and still, you know, continue to have a strong relationship with all those people. I mean, I texted with Blitzer recently and with Ray, and, you know, Lou as well somewhat recently. So it's, you know, it's the nature of the business that things can change. And I just think at that point for the Devils, I think everyone was a little bit blindsided by how quickly things changed based on where the team was kind of at in that period between 2014 and 2016.
I'm not sure I've seen a team effectively navigate that kind of part of their time. Like, I've seen you've seen teams like the Red Wings, or even, you know, the Kings are trying to go through it, the Blackhawks on some level, that like end of an era, work in young talent, that is such a hard time in a franchise's development. I don't know anyone that's found the right answers there, other than just kind of going through the painful process of restarting and tearing it down, which is not fun.
Especially
for those who've built it up.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
All right. So you enter the hockey space. What was the last job you had before you kind of got into the hockey world? Was it Chicago? Was trading in Chicago?
I don't remember. I guess the quick time, you know, the quick version of the timeline was that I went to college for music. I had moved to New Orleans to play music full time, and then discovered poker kind of first in my free time. And then the timing was just really, really lucky in terms of kind of getting interested in poker and having a knack for it right around the time when poker exploded in popularity. And so I ended up basically playing poker for a living for 7 years and writing 2 poker books. And I guess, you know, I grew up playing hockey, and hockey was always kind of my sport. And I guess kind of concurrently with the poker boom was also, it really was kind of like, timing wise, it really overlapped in with the whole Moneyball experience with analytics just, you know, exploding into sports and particularly baseball. And so I guess I had always kind of thought to myself that at that time that this sort of thinking and reasoning could be applied to hockey, just, I mean, because hockey was my sport. And so, you know, I met the other 6 or 7 people on the internet back in 2006 that were interested in hockey advanced statistics. And so, you know, we had all kind of befriended each other and commented on each other's blogs and did our own sort of research. And I guess it all started basically when Matt Hulsizer kind of reached out to me out of the blue and said, hey, you know, I've read some of your stuff. Would you be interested in consulting for the Coyotes? I'm considering buying them. And so that was, I guess, my first foray into NHL, into the NHL space. And that was around 2011. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, so that was basically like his bid to buy the team fell through. And by that point, he and I had become friends. And he said, you know, I think in the interim until I find another team to potentially buy, I think you should come to Chicago and let us teach you how to trade options because it's really, really similar to poker and some of the other skill sets you have. So that was when I left poker, was around 2011. And I was trading options. I think I was in Chicago for 3 years and then left to join the Devils in 2014 and was there until the 2017-18 season. And then that's when I went back and did my master's in data science and consulted for the Caps and worked for Zealous and started with the Panthers, I guess, October of 2020.
What can you explain what a derivatives trader is in Chicago? Like what, like, and why poker set you up for that success?
I guess it's not much different than what I mentioned earlier about the hockey draft. It's all decision making under uncertainty, right? It's all understanding risk and probability and making the best decisions you can, you know, given the uncertain circumstances with which you're presented. And so in poker, that was, I mean, in some ways, poker is a lot easier because there's only 52 cards in the deck, right? I mean, it's still really, really hard. There's still, you know, tons and tons of combinations as well as, you know, tons and tons of human personality types and archetypes to which you have imperfect information to make your decisions. But it's still a somewhat bounded world. Whereas derivatives trading, you know, you're talking about financial markets, which is just, I mean, this is a good time to be talking about it because as you saw with the whole GameStop thing recently, just the tails of the distribution are so much more unknown in financial markets than they are in either poker or hockey. I mean, I actually think hockey is much more similar to poker than it is to financial markets.
Think it is?
Yeah, for sure it is. Because, I mean, the thing that we're betting on, which is hockey players and player outcomes, player talent, a lot of that stuff tends to be normally distributed, Gaussian or, you know, bell curve. Because, I mean, if you imagine it this way, it's like, how fast does the fastest pitcher throw right now? Maybe 104 or something like that?
Yeah, that sounds
right. What's the equivalent for a slap shot? I don't know, maybe 120, 125?
Okay.
Whatever that number is, you know, maybe tomorrow that number will get broken, right? Like maybe tomorrow we'll find someone somewhere in the world that can throw 107 miles an hour, 105 miles an hour. Okay, that might be true, but there's no chance in hell that someone tomorrow is going to throw like 210 miles an hour.
Right?
Okay. Right? Whereas we see this all the time in financial markets. It's like, you know, maybe the most that Microsoft ever moved on earnings in the past was like 12%. And there's no law at all that says it couldn't move 112% tomorrow. And again, we saw this with GameStop and we've seen it before. Right. Maybe not to that extent, but like just, yeah, the tails are so enormous in financial markets compared to other avenues, particularly professional sports. Because I just think in professional sports, so much stuff is just bounded. It's a physical action. So we're bounded by the physics of what's humanly possible. And a lot of that stuff tends to be pretty normally distributed.
So, all right, if we're making the poker comparison, which there's the, you know, it's the constraints are the 52 cards in the deck. And in hockey, the constraints are the range of talent is going to be close. How do you identify the difference? Like, where's your parallel with poker? Is it finding the differences or trying to find the advantages? I imagine.
Yeah. I mean, I don't necessarily think what I just said necessarily makes one subject matter easier or harder to... I mean, I guess in some ways it does. It does make it a little bit easier when the tails are thinner. But it doesn't necessarily mean that there's no... that it doesn't necessarily correlate with how much edge you have. Like, even though derivatives markets are, like I said, much more fat-tailed, they're also much, much harder just because it's so competitive. Like, there's just so many smart people in that market. It's such a exhausted market. Like, it's been competitive and just, you know, the market's been beaten upon for years and years and years and years. So it's just such a difficult market to beat. And poker's gotten more like that. I mean, poker, when I was playing professionally, it was easier, you know? Any market, I think, when it's immature, is much easier to solve, much easier to find edge in. And, you know, I mean, there's a lot of smart people out there. So if you give them time and resources, they're going to figure things out. And so I think that's happened. I mean, especially in poker, that's happened a lot in the recent maybe 10 years or something. It's changed significantly.
So if the finance world is the far end of the spectrum, poker is getting there. Where is hockey on that journey?
It's hard to say. I do think there's still quite a bit of edge in the hockey world. Mm-hmm. I also think there are aspects of it that are, there's not necessarily a lot of edge. I don't know if I necessarily say it that way, but it is fairly developed. I mean, when you think about hockey's been around a long time, and a lot of the aspects of strategy and on-ice stuff has gone through the rigor of trial and error over time, you know, that sort of survivorship with things failing and then moving on and then successful things tending to stick around. So I do think there is aspects of that, but I also do think just because it has been a sport that's largely been absent of scrutiny data-wise, I do think that, you know, there still is a lot of edge on that side of things. Using information well can still, I think, go a long way in hockey.
I agree with you that time maybe has solved some of that, if that makes sense, right? Just from sheer... hockey has been around a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And things seem to, if you do get an edge, it seems like it doesn't take long for it to disappear, right? Like if somebody discovers, hey, the 1-3-1 power play, we shouldn't have two defensemen. Like the numbers don't add up. And maybe you have an edge for 2 months or whatever, right? It's not like 10 years or anything.
Absolutely. That's true of every market, and hockey's no different.
Yeah.
Coaches are good traders. You know,
in terms of
the things that they're good at, they're totally dialed into that kind of thing. And like you said, if someone comes up with something new, they figure it out pretty quickly.
What other parallels between, I like the idea of poker being a parallel to hockey in some way or related. Where else do you see that? I want to explore.
Oh, there's so many. Yeah. I mean, fundamentally just the idea that, you know, I think one of the things you have to be really good at in poker is you really have to be good at figuring out what are the things that you can control and separating those from the things that you can't control and then working to get better at the things you can control. Like being also then really good at analyzing the things you can control and then getting better at them. And once you sort of do those things, there's still this total... you know, element of randomness that you can't control. I mean, you can do everything right and still lose because you're supposed to, you know. If you get your money in as an 80-20 favorite, that's like an enormously profitable situation. And it also means that you're going to lose 20% of the time. You're supposed to lose. The universe demands that you're going to lose 20% of the time. And so, you have to be okay with that. Like and that's a really hard thing for humans. I don't think it's in accordance with our human nature in a lot of ways. So, you know, I do think you can train yourself to get better at that, both in terms of controlling your emotions and not letting it cloud your judgment and making sure that whatever you do next time is not driven by results, but driven by what you deem to be the proper probabilities or the process. And I think hockey's really, really similar in that regard. You know, I mean, relative to other major sports, there's just so much more randomness in hockey compared to, say, basketball. And so I think there's a lot of that's true. A lot, you know, a lot of games in hockey are 55-45s or 65-35s at best, and you're going to lose. You know, you might be the favorite, you might do everything right, and you're still sometimes going to lose. And so you need to, I think, teams that are good at understanding that immediately have an edge, because it means that you're not going to be reactionary, you're not going to make decisions that are based on results as opposed to the process. And so, yeah, I just think there's so many parallels in that way.
I agree. And I mean, you see it in the course of a game or a playoff series, that randomness that is, you know, losing on the river is a puck off somebody's shin that you know, you did everything right. And
Oh, yeah. It
takes two bounces and then it goes in and you're like, what are you going to do? How much, like, where do you see the most randomness in hockey? Like, how much randomness really is there?
Well, I don't know how to exactly express that other than, I mean, I think one easy way to express that is just in the probabilities of different teams winning at different times. That's a simple way to start that conversation.
Yeah.
And I think if you look at that distribution of probabilities, it's just way narrower than other sports. You know, I mean, if I like to use this example where I think a few years ago in the first round of the hockey playoffs, I want to say there wasn't a single series in the first round in which the favorite, the team that was favored by more than 2-1. Mm-hmm. And I want to say that in that exact same year, in the first round of the NBA playoffs, there were two series in which the favorite was favored 50-1.
That's crazy.
Yes. Yes. And you know, if you want to know, like, how I arrived at those numbers, I mean, you could look at a lot of different things. You could look at just historical data. You could look at betting lines. You could look at, I mean, it doesn't matter how you slice it and dice it. You'll come right to a pretty similar answer, which is that there's just so much more luck in hockey than there is in a sport like basketball.
So, all right, let me rephrase the question then. What can you control when it comes to winning in hockey from a management point of view?
You can control outplaying the other team, I think, is like the most general sort of way of looking at that. You know, I mean, you can control whether you sort of your expected wins, you know, you can control your, you know, did you do all the things that lead to winning better than them? And can we put an estimate on that? And can we say, yes, we did? Or, I mean, it's not binary, but it's more like, yeah, we did, and based on that, we'd expect to win this game 60% of the time. And, you know, that's kind of how I think of things. Like, when I think of the goals for the team and the goals in hockey, for me, the goal is always to just increase that number. I mean, you'll hear, you know, probably at every interview that a general manager has with ownership, it's probably like, what's the goal? Well, the goal is to win the Stanley Cup. I mean, you know, my perspective, this is just my opinion, but like that's a ridiculous goal. I mean, that's just absurd because there's so much luck, you know, like even if you have the best team in hockey, if you have the best team in history in hockey, I don't know, maybe you're like 18% to win the cup or something like that. I mean, it's so small. So to me, you know, from my perspective, the goal was always to just keep trying to increase your probability of winning, and everything else, you know, you can't really control. I mean, it doesn't mean that I don't get upset about it sometimes, because I'm human. But that, you know, from my perspective, that's sort of the goal.
Are you able to, like in poker, are you able to clinically look at a bad beat and say, I had my money in the best odds? Great. And same with hockey. Or, how do you remove that human emotion? Like you said, we're not wired to think that way or feel that way.
Yeah, I mean, I've gotten, I guess I would say, pretty good at it just from the years and years of doing it. But it doesn't mean that I still don't get upset. I think I probably just get a lot less upset than most people and just think about the outcome differently. I mean, you know, when I see amateur poker players take a bad beat, just the whole way they think about it is just often very wrong. Like, oh, I should have, like, they, you know, they try to think in terms of what could I have done differently, as opposed to not even what could I have done differently, but like they think to themselves, I should not have done that. I must have done something wrong. When often right. That's not the case at all. Whereas I will, you know, at least when I was playing for a living, a lot of my focus was like, let me just go back and make sure I didn't do anything wrong here. You know, like if I went back and reviewed a session, I would have tons of hands that I like hand histories that I would flag that I would go back and take a look at. And so I would look and say, I think, you know, I think this was just a bad beat, but let me go back and take a look at it. And then let me look back and say like, well, okay, you know, I raised them on the flop here. Did that make sense? And then I'll analyze that one decision. And a lot of times I will come back to like, no, you know, I was pretty happy with that. I was pretty happy with that decision. And I also think the dangerous thing is you have to do that when you win too. I mean, you know, there's luck on both sides. So I would try to even review hands that I would win and say the same thing. Like, did I do something wrong here? The problem is, again, human nature. You're much less likely to be introspective when you're winning compared to when you're losing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So in that respect, you know, losing is not a bad thing in a lot of ways. You know, like going on a losing streak or going, even if it is primarily driven by bad luck or, you know, some combination of luck and skill, it's still not necessarily a bad thing because those are the moments when you tend to sort of focus on analyzing the things you can do differently going forward. And you usually do improve, whether that's as a poker player or as a hockey team.
Right. So I like you guys, as we record this, and this will be posted next week, but you're 8-2-2, the Florida Panthers, like off to this great start. And I don't know, like without having, you know, Do you meet with Joel and you're like, hey, we may be 8-2-2, but we should be X, Y, and Z. You know, we should be 500 or whatever, or maybe better. Like, do you guys have those discussions so you are managing expectations or making sure you're mentally in the right place? Like, absolutely. Do the coaches look at it that way?
Oh, yeah, okay. Absolutely. Yeah. It might not necessarily be phrased as 8-2-2 versus 6.3-2. You know, I mean, that might necessarily be that most
you should really be
way.
To do.
I mean, I might look at that myself, but for the coaches, every game, everything that happens, there's dialogue in terms of, well, here's what we did well, and here's what we didn't do well, and that is from my perspective, that's irrespective of whether it's a win or a loss. You know, and so there's a lot of benefit in that. You know, because yeah, we're 8-2-2, and I'm emotionally very, very happy about that, you know. But on top of that, the statistician in me is cautious to say, listen, this is a very small sample size, 11 games. And so the results of any 11-game stretch are almost entirely noise. So I'm not really looking at that, you know. I'm looking at a lot of the underlying stuff. And
right.
On that part, I'm pleased too, though. You know, I mean, I think we are playing well. I think we're playing really well, and so that's the part that I'm really psyched about.
Yeah, I was going to say, is it a legit 8-2-2? If you could share, you feel good about it.
Again, I don't want to say the 8-2-2 like the numbers part of it is. I mean, I think going 8-2-2 takes a lot of luck, even if you're the best team in the league. Which
right,
yeah. I'm not going to sit here and say we are, but if I'm being honest, I do think we've played really well. You know, I think the changes that we made as a front office, a lot of the things Bill has implemented, both in terms of the structure, the new players, the culture, a lot of the stuff is just, it's paid off. And, you know, I see it in the numbers that I'm looking at. And so, again, it's still really early days, but I guess my only point was just that's the sort of thing I'm looking at, not so much
right. The
record.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone?
Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/credit card.
All right, so Sonny, you okay, like, can you just share, you know, you were living in New Orleans, Hurricane Katrina hit, and it seems, you know, that seemed to be a pretty big moment in terms of you moved to Vegas after that. What was that point in time like for you in, you know, kind of to live in that space in such a historical moment?
Man, you're good. I don't know how you dug that up, but that was, yeah, you're 100% right. That was like a huge turning point, Hurricane Katrina.
Yeah.
But that, I mean, that's good, good reporting there. That was 2005, a long time ago.
Yeah. We're going way back.
Yeah. Yeah. It was crazy, you know, cause I think, so up till that point, I had been kind of splitting time between being a full-time musician and starting to play poker more seriously. And basically, like, I would say, like, the couple years leading up to that, or maybe the year leading up to that, it was sort of the thing where, well, I was getting really into poker and getting better at it and studying it a lot. And it was sort of the thing where it allowed me to just kind of turn down some of the shitty music gigs that I didn't want to do because I didn't need the money as much. And it was kind of like it was kind of morphing into like spending more and more time playing poker and less playing music. But then Katrina really changed everything because, so yeah, it was crazy, man. It was completely nuts. I was in the casino playing 5-10 no limit at Harrah's until 5 a.m. the morning of the storm. And the poker manager, I remember he came over to our table and said, "Hey guys, I've actually never said this to anybody since we've opened the casino, but the casino's closing in 30 minutes. We're actually closing the casino. We've never done that. But, you know, this storm is real and you guys better get the hell out of here." And so I ended up only going about an hour north to some friends, kind of like a country house. About an hour north, but we still got hit pretty hard there. I mean, we were safe. We weren't necessarily in danger, but, you know, I remember going out the morning after the storm and kind of inspecting everything, and it was crazy. Like, there were just pine trees down everywhere. Like, the whole air just, all you smelled was pine from all the pine trees. And my car was blocked in. There was no electricity. And so I actually ended up hitchhiking to the Baton Rouge airport. And, on the floor of the Baton Rouge airport because they didn't have any flights till the next morning. And then I took a flight out to California to go stay with my mom for a few days. And, you know, I had no idea when I was next going to be able to go back to my place in New Orleans. So, at that time we didn't realize how bad it was. So it became apparent to me once I got out there that like it could be months before I could go back. So I kind of said, well, it had all been kind of leading up to this anyway, so I'm going to go to Vegas and play poker full time. And so that was like just a huge turning point because, you know, things went really well for me in Vegas and I ended up getting a book deal. And so, yeah, it was nuts. It was crazy.
Were you confident you could go there and succeed, or was there a learning curve to make that leap from the casinos in New Orleans to full time in Vegas?
I was confident, but in retrospect, I'm sure it was just being young enough to not know any better, you know?
Yeah.
I do think, again, it was just, I was lucky in that I think I kind of got into poker, like really, really into poker analysis and getting good at poker, just like call it 9 months or a year ahead of the curve. So that, you know, suddenly all these people started playing poker and they were just far less trained than I was at that point. That's obviously changed in the 15 years since then. But at that point in time, the timing was just really, really good. So like everything, right? It's a combination of luck and skill.
I know a lot is, and I don't know that space that well, but I know a lot has changed in the poker world in terms of strategy and, you know, now you wrote the book Professional No Limit Hold'em Volume 1, does it stand up? Like, is it still advice you would give today?
I don't know. It's been a long time since I've read it. But from what I've talked to people who have read it, friends and stuff who have read it, people who are into poker, and they do say it does. I think the good thing is that that book, especially the first book, was kind of geared at like low, medium stakes live games. And those games haven't changed a ton. It's really like the higher stakes online games that are completely different now than they were back when I played. And, you know, it's funny because, again, the parallels to hockey and other industries, but one of the big things that's changed poker so much in the last 10 years is, I guess, the equivalent of analytics, which
that's
is,
right.
You know, they've started, you know, using these solvers, which are basically like huge, you know, intense number crunchers to kind of solve what perfect strategy would be, meaning like game theory optimal. Like if you were playing against a perfect, you know, a person who played quote unquote perfect strategy, which is really, really, really hard in poker because there's so many decision points and it's, you don't know what your opponent has. So it's a lot different than solving blackjack, but they're getting closer and closer. And I think, you know, the best players are using that information and incorporating it as best as they can into their own game. And so they're playing closer and closer to perfect. So it's, you know, getting harder and harder to beat.
I wonder if there's a game theory optimal for hockey. You know what I mean? Is there the optimal way to play?
I have to think about that. That's a really good question.
I don't know. Yeah. Those are the things.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager. Victorinox, the makers of the original Swiss Army knife, have been a reliable companion for life's everyday challenges, mastering functionality, innovation, iconic design, and uncompromising quality with its products. The Victorinox Swiss Army Knife provides you with all the things you don't think about until you need it. Tweezers, a screwdriver, and even a corkscrew. With the Victorinox Swiss Army Knife, you can be prepared to master everyday life. You can find Victorinox Swiss Army Knives at Dick's Sporting Goods.
All right, I know we're jammed up for time, but I do want to, we'll lightning round these questions because cool. We got some, there was funds. So this, I'm gonna let my colleagues have the early say. Myrtle wanted to know, he wants to hear about your years as a jazz musician in New Orleans. What do you have a best jazz musician story?
There's a lot, but I guess one of my favorite ones was that when I first got to New Orleans, my first regular gig was the 2 a.m. set at the Spotted Cat on Frenchman Street. It was the Friday night 2 a.m. set. And so people always kind of thought, when I tell my wife now about that, she's like, wait, you started at 2 a.m.? I'm like, yeah, it was the 2 a.m. to 5 a.m. set. And it was packed. Friday nights at 2 a.m. on Frenchman Street in New Orleans was like, yeah, it was good times. But, you know, I was 24, so.
What'd you play?
Guitar. Jazz guitar.
Guitar.
Yeah.
Mike Russo wants to know, he says, my grandfather told me to never chase inside straights. Was he right?
No, he was not right. There's no such thing as you should never do this or you should always do that, particularly as it pertains to something like catching an inside straight. So an inside straight, you know, is you have four to a straight, but the one that you need is on the inside, which means that there's four, on average, there's going to be four cards that make your hand. So as with almost everything in poker, it all just depends on the odds. So if you're getting the right odds, you absolutely should chase an inside straight if the odds dictate that you should. And if the odds dictate that you shouldn't, then you should fold. But that's not inherent just to the inside straight. That's true of any hand. I mean, whether you have a flush draw or, you know, an open-ended straight draw, it all depends on what the situation is. So what, you know, what are the odds that the pot is immediately offering you, as well as what we call implied odds in poker, which is how much could you potentially make on later streets. And then there's also further layers too, which is like, well, if I miss my straight, is there another straight card? Another scare card that I could represent to then potentially bluff. Mm. So then you have some bluffing equity, is what we call it. So
I don't have the other scare card in my game. I don't factor that in. I'm not thinking of that. I got to work that in. All right. This question comes from Days3232, who wonders, he points out the moves that the Panthers have made this offseason clearly show there's an analytically minded organization, but what would you say the ratio between numbers and the eye test is with the Panthers? Does that exist?
No, I don't think that exists. No. At least I certainly don't think of it that way. And honestly, I don't want to speak for him, but I don't think Bill thinks of it in terms of a ratio. As I kind of mentioned earlier, I think the way he's structured the front office is just it's all collaborative. It's all information. There's really no difference, right? Like whether my, you know, I think such and such. I mean, first of all, it's not like analytics says anything. The analyst says something. I mean, data is neutral. Mm-hmm. It's how you interpret that data that is doing statistics. So, you know, my point is just that whatever my opinion might be about a player, someone else might have an opinion, and there's no like ratio. It's just all part of the, goes into the mix for Bill making a decision.
This is a similar question from Giancarlo, who wonders about the transition to convince the, or to close the gap between the old school scouting, kind of the eye test folks and the analytics folks. How do you bring the worlds together? What's been your strategy to make sure, you know, you guys are speaking the same language?
You know, for me, I think that fortunately or whatever, that really has not ever been a huge problem. Like even in Jersey, okay. I mean, I got along really, really well with the coaches and the scouts. I think, you know, maybe just because my background is a bit different. For me, it was never the point of quote unquote analytics was never really to supplant coaches or scouts. That's kind of ridiculous to me. I mean, even you know, in trading, you have an analyst for a reason. You know, like if you're a derivatives trader, you don't necessarily know the most about oil, and so you want to get the opinion of someone who knows a lot about oil because it helps you in making, you know, in structuring your position the best. And so I think about that similarly in hockey, where there's just things that coaches and scouts are. They're just always going to be better at knowing those things than I am. They're good at those skills. They have more experience in them. And it's really valuable information in terms of helping the team make a, you know, integrated decision. So, I don't know. I never really thought of it in terms of closing the gap or any of that stuff. To me, it's always just been a blend of working. You know, it's all working together. That's the only way it really can be.
Who's the best poker player in the Florida Panthers organization besides yourself? Have you guys played at all?
No, not much. Not much with COVID and all that stuff. You know, it's
That's true. Yeah.
Yeah. Poker's not really the touching a bunch of chips and cards and passing them around to each other and all sitting within the, you know, a few inches of each other. It's not a great activity for COVID.
I just think I'd want to be sitting on the other side of the table from Rick Dudley. That's all. If I could see him flipping a table over. At some point, that's all.
Oh man, when Duds takes off the jacket, the guns are out, man. He's amazing. Yeah, he's awesome.
He is. Well, Sonny, thanks for doing this. This was a lot of fun.
Thanks, Craig. Appreciate it.
I want to thank Sonny for doing this show. It was great to talk to him. I hope, like, I'm a giant poker nerd. Like, this was like the combination of everything that I like. Hockey, people that are willing to do a lot of things in their life. I'm extremely jealous of somebody like Sonny, and it was a pleasure to get to talk to him about all the things that he's gone through and going through. And as we speak, Florida's actually doing better than when we recorded. Unbelievable what's happening with the Florida Panthers right now. One of the interesting things that I really liked talking to him about was analytics in the draft, because you don't hear a lot about it. And I can tell you, in conversations I'm having right now with people around the league, when the draft for 2021 is going to be held is becoming a real point of contention. For instance, I was talking yesterday to an executive with a team and who felt like there was a lot of momentum for back-to-back drafts in the summer of 2022, which makes sense if you're a team. You don't want these draft picks are huge. You don't want to mess them up. You want to have a lot of time to evaluate these players. And the reality is teams haven't gotten that opportunity right just yet. It just hasn't happened because of COVID. And so I can tell you GMs are pushing for it. The flip side, and I had a conversation with an agent about it, it messes some things up in terms of when a contract kicks in. Does it mess up? Let's say a player gets drafted later than normal. Do they hit free agency, unrestricted free agency later than they would? There's all these implications that have to be ironed out. But I can tell you the idea of having two giant drafts in a short period of time is fascinating. Me, I would like to see them personally take this opportunity to make the 19-year-old draft a reality. I think it's asking a lot of teams to be evaluating players who are 16, 17 and making decisions at 18. I think this, like, when else are you going to have this moment in history where you can make yourself, where you can completely change how the draft is done? But I realize that has all of its own issues, even though I'm a fan of that solution. So that's one area I'm going to be watching really closely. Anyways, not to get completely sidetracked. Before we wrap up, I do want to highlight a couple really good podcasts on The Athletic, NHL Network. Keith Tkachuk, former Atlanta Thrasher. That's how I remember Keith, because I was covering the team when he got traded to Atlanta. He joined Ian Mendez and Haley Salvian on The Hockey Show. Pierre-Luc Dubois of your Winnipeg Jets and Steve Mayer joined Scott Burnside and Pierre LeBrun on Two-Man Advantage version of The Hockey Show. And Steve Dangle was Jonas Siegel and James Myrtle's guest on this week's Leaf Report at The Athletic. Steve is awesome and funny and entertaining and was a great guest. So make sure you check those out. Great stuff. As always, if you have a second to rate this podcast, The Full 60, on Apple, I would greatly appreciate it. Take 2 seconds to do that, and I will be eternally grateful for that. And if you're not subscribing to The Athletic and you want a discount, go to theathletic.com/full60 to get in at $3.99 per month. And I can tell you, with all of the trade deadline stuff we've got coming, it will be worth your time. Thank you again to Sonny for joining the podcast. Thank you for listening, and have a great week.